Tony, Alan Mees, Javier Mish, who's still here on this one. And Katarina Agaraki is going to give the talk.
Berkeley and Lancaster University. So this talk is about building routers, and in particular routers that are fast and programmable, which means that we can easily add new functionality to them. For instance, we can make them collect new types of statistics, we can make them perform new types of packet filtering, packet transformations, in general, any kind of new packet processing that we want. Now, it's pretty clear why a router should be fast. The question is, why should it be programmable? One could argue that all a router needs to do is receive packets, look at their headers, and determine where to send them next. Well, first of all, programmable routers enable ISPs, that is Internet Service Providers, to offer new useful services to their customers. For instance, application acceleration, denial of service protection, intrusion detection, all these are useful services that require custom packet processing. Second, programmable routers make network monitoring, hence troubleshooting, significantly easier. Very simple tasks, like measuring the latency of a network link, become needlessly complicated when you cannot tell a router to perform a simple operation, like add timestamps to packets. Finally, there's all these interesting new protocols that researchers have proposed. And I'm not talking about complicated, exotic stuff. I'm talking about simple, straightforward solutions to pressing problems, like IP traceback or new source record route that would help solve source address spoofing. Now, without programmable routers, the deployment of such new protocols becomes very difficult. So we want programmable routers because they help us, they enable us to build flexible, extensible networks. The problem is that today, programmability comes at the cost of performance. Routers today are either fast or programmable, but not both. On the one hand, we have hardware routers where packet processing is performed by specialized hardware, and these can be quite fast. They can handle terabits per second, 10 gig or 40 gig ports, and hundreds or thousands of ports. But they offer zero programmability. On the other hand, we have software routers where packet processing is performed by general purpose processors, and these are, of course, programmable, but they can barely handle 10 gigabits per second or so, so orders of magnitude below the terabits per second that hardware routers can handle. The ultimate goal of this project was to see to what extent we can narrow this divide. To what extent can we build routers that are both fast and programmable? Now, there are multiple ways of approaching this problem. We could do all sorts of interesting combinations between general purpose components and specialist components, but as a very first step, we took an extreme approach. We said, let's look at a purely general purpose solution, a purely software router, and let's see how much performance we can get out of it. Our solution is RouteBricks, and it is a router that consists of off-the-shelf PCs. The advantage of this approach, as I said before, programmability, a familiar development environment, and all the good things that come together with large volume manufacturing, like low costs and widespread supply support chains. The big question, of course, is performance. Can we build a terabit per second router out of off-the-shelf PCs? Now, before I jump into the details, I will give you a high-level overview of RouteBricks, and let me start with a few definitions. For the purposes of this talk, a router is an entity that receives, processes, and forwards packets. In particular, a packet is received at one of the input ports of the router, it is processed and switched to one of the output ports. I will be using two variables throughout the talk. N is the number of external ports of the router, in this particular example, they are four. And R is the external line rate of the router, that is, the maximum number of bits per second that each of the router's ports can handle. So if we look at the typical hardware router today, it consists, first of all, of line cards. A line card is a piece of hardware that is responsible for handling one, perhaps a few, external router ports, and performs all the processing necessary for the packets that arrive at these ports. Hence, a line card must be able to handle packets at a rate proportional to the line card. A hardware router also has a switch fabric, which is responsible for reading packets from their input ports, that is, the line cards where they arrive, and writing them to the right output ports. Hence, a switch fabric must operate at a rate n times r. This is what a hardware router looks like, and this is what route bricks looks like. We have replaced line cards with general-purpose commodity servers. Now, each server is responsible for handling one or a few external router ports. Hence, each server must be able to process packets at a rate proportional to the line rate r. There is no centralized switch fabric in route bricks. The switching is performed by the servers themselves, which are connected through a commodity interconnect. So as we will see, each server must also be able to switch packets at a rate proportional to the line rate r. Now, the thing to keep from all this introduction is that in route bricks, each server must be able to process packets at a rate c times r, where c is a small constant independent from the total number of ports n of the router. And this is the key point that ensures the scalability of our architecture. Now, here's the outline for the rest of the talk. First, I will describe our interconnect, how we put our servers together. I will zoom into each single server and describe what optimization we did to get better performance. I will present some performance results and conclude. Let me start with the requirements for our interconnect. First of all, we want the internal links that we put in here to be of as low rate as possible. Why? Because low rate internal links lead to a cheaper solution. As I said before, to achieve scalability, we want each of our servers to process packets at a rate proportional to the line rate r, but independent from the total number of ports n of the router. In the same spirit, we want the per-server fanout, that is the number of other servers that each server connects to be some small, reasonable value, again, independent from the total number of ports n. So if we have a router that has 100 ports or 1,000 ports, we don't want each server to have to connect to 100 or 1,000 other servers. So how do we go about building an interconnect that satisfies these three requirements? Let's consider this simple example where we want to build a router that has four ports. And we have four servers, so we assign one port to each server. So in this picture I'm showing here, each server plays two roles. It acts as an input node and as an output node. And let's suppose that we have traffic arriving at this input port at full line rate r, and it is all addressed to this particular output port. The straightforward thing to do would be to interconnect this input and output port with a fat internal link of line rate r. However, if we did that for each input-output port pair, we would end up with a solution like this, where to support n external links of capacity r, we end up using n square internal links also of capacity r. It turns out that we can do better by using the Valiant load balancing architecture, which was proposed by Valiant in 96. So Valiant load balancing introduces a third intermediate stage into the network. Now, each of our four servers in this example is not playing only the role of an input and an output node, but also of an intermediate node. Now, when traffic arrives at an input port, instead of being sent directly to the output port where it is addressed, it is first uniformly spread, load balanced, across all the clusters in the server, all the servers in the cluster. In a second phase, the traffic is reassembled to the right output port. Now, what this does is remove the need to interconnect this input and this output port with a fat link of rate r, because we're spreading the load between these two ports across multiple thinner links. So if we do the math with Valiant load balancing, in order to support n external links of rate r, we need a square internal links, but not of capacity r, of capacity 2r over n, which is significantly smaller. So that's the key point of Valiant load balancing. In terms of per-server processing, with this architecture, each server must be able to process packets at the rate 3 times r. Where is this 3 coming from? I said before that each server plays three roles as an input, intermediate, and output node. at each of these stages, it may be receiving traffic, in the worst case, at rate R. This is where these three R is coming from. There is one optimization we can do. If the router is handling uniform traffic patterns, then each server must only process packets at rate 2R rather than 3R, and the explanation for this is in the paper. So far, that's really valuable balancing offers us a solution where we have low internal links, low capacity internal links, and server and lower server processing requirements. But what about fan-out? The way I described things so far, if we have endpoints, we also have N servers, and each server must be connected to N other server. So if N is 100 or 1,000, it's not a feasible solution. So what can we do to reduce the per-server fan-out? One thing we can do is increase the per-server processing capacity. If we have faster servers, then we can assign not one, but multiple external router ports to each server, which means that we need fewer boxes in order to support the same number of external ports, and hence fewer interconnections between them. So that's one thing we can do. Another thing we can do is add intermediate nodes. We do not need to connect each input and output port with a direct physical link. Instead, we can add a constant degree network in the middle. And what we do is use a generalized butterfly network, a k-degree n-stage butterfly network, and the details are again in the paper. So our solution is a combination of these two techniques. We take each server, we assign to it the maximum number of external router ports that the server can handle. If we can, we interconnect all the servers in a full mesh, and if we don't have enough per server fan-out, then we use a generalized butterfly network. So the question is, how big a router can we build in this way? How many ports can we support, and how many servers do we need to support a certain number of router ports? The answer, of course, depends on what kind of servers we have. And if RouteBricks becomes a product, that will be in 3-4 years from now, so we'll have much better servers than we have today. But to be conservative, I will assume currently available servers. I will assume servers that do not support more than 5 network card slots, and they cannot handle more than 1 external router port. Using such servers, we can use RouteBricks and build a router that supports 32 ports, where we have 1 server per port and all the servers are interconnected in a full mesh. If we want more ports than this, then we need to add intermediate nodes. To give an extreme example, if we wanted to build a router with 1,000 ports, we would need 2 additional nodes per port. Let me recap. Our interconnect is a valid load balanced network. It is either a full mesh or a generalized butterfly network. And the important thing to keep from this is that each server must process packets at a rate between 2 and 3R, where R is the external line rate. This means that to build a router that supports a 10 gig external line rate, we need servers that can process packets at rates between 20 and 30 gigabits per second. So can general purpose servers, commodity servers, handle such rates? This brings me to the second part of the talk, what we need inside a server to improve its performance. I will not talk about the first server we tried, which was a Xeon shared bus architecture. That effort is documented in the paper. This is the second server we tried. It was a non-uniform memory access architecture, in particular a Intel Nehalem box with these characteristics. So we installed CLIP, the CLIP programming framework, on this box, and we blasted it with minimum size packets. We programmed the box to perform no op forwarding, so simply read packets from the input ports, write them to the output ports, nothing fancy. Our goal was to measure the sheer throughput that this box could handle. The first number we got was 1.3 gigabits per second. That's the performance we got out of the box. And it turned out that our bottleneck was adding CPUs. We were running out of processing cycles. Investigation showed that a lot of these cycles were spent not in actually processing the packets, but in what we call the bookkeeping operations. So for those of you that are familiar with the Linux networking details, managing packet descriptors and moving them between the network cards and memory. So to reduce this overhead, we use batching. We try to amortize this cost across multiple packets. To this end, we configured our network cards to put multiple packet descriptors in each transaction, and also we had to configure CLIP to pull for multiple packets at the same time from memory. So we used this simple optimization, and indeed we got a better performance of 3 gigabits per second. But it turned out that there was still room for improvement, and it had to do with the way the processing cores accessed the network cards. And I'm going to demonstrate with a few simple examples. So I'm going to keep 2 network ports and 2 processing cores. So rectangles here are ports, and circles are processing cores. And let's consider this simple setup, where we have 1 input, 1 output port, 2 processing cores sharing the load, the traffic between these 2 ports. The problem with this setup is that it has synchronization overhead, because you have 2 processing cores, and they're accessing at the same time the same network queues at the input and output port. Keep locking and unlocking these queues, we have synchronization overhead. So to get rid of this overhead, we decided to use a simple rule. We said, well, we're going to use only a single processing core per network port, as in this setup. Now consider this slightly more complicated scenario, where we have 2 inputs and 2 output ports, and again 2 processing cores in the middle. In this setup, we're using a single core accessing each network port, so no locking and unlocking overhead, but we're having cache misses, because now each packet is handled by 2 cores. So to get rid of these cache misses, we said, well, we're going to apply a second rule. We're going to have each packet touched only by a single core, as in this setup I'm showing here. Now, the problem with these 2 rules is that you cannot enforce always both of them at the same time. And let me demonstrate why. Let's say here we have 1 input, 1 output port, 1 core in the middle, but this core is not enough. There's too much traffic between these ports. 1 core cannot handle it. So we want to add more cores to help. How can we do that? We can do it this way, put more cores in the middle. But then we're violating our first rule, because now multiple cores are accessing each network queue. Or we could try a scenario like this, where we have 1 core accessing each port, but now we're violating our second rule, because now each packet is accessed actually by 3 rather than 1 core. The solution is to use network cards that have multiple queues per port, and this technology is already available today. So if in our example here, our input and output port have multiple queues, then we can use multiple cores, assign a single queue to each core, and then we're not having any synchronization overhead and we don't have any cache misses. So we updated our rules, we said we're going to use 1 core, not per port, but per network queue, and 1 core per packet. So indeed we used this optimization, and indeed we got significantly better performance of 9.7 gigabits per second. Let me recap what optimizations we did inside each single server. Well, first of all, this is not an optimization, it's a matter of using the right hardware. It didn't matter to use the non-uniform memory access architecture, the reasons are documented in the paper, and it didn't matter to use multi-queue NICs, they saved us from cache misses and synchronization overhead. We had to modify, to write a NIC device driver for our network cards to do the batching I described before. And finally, we enforced a very simple queue-to-core allocation rules. So 1 core per packet and 1 core per networking. So we used all these optimizations, and let's see what kind of performance we got. I have already said that given a minimum size packet workload and no forwarding, we got 9.7 gigabits per second. But in reality, traffic does not consist of minimum size packets, so we also consider a realistic packet size mix that we got from real packet traces. And indeed, with such a mix, we got better performance, 25 gigabits per second. We also implemented IPv4 routing and IPsec, which I do not show here, it's in the paper. Okay, so are these numbers now good or bad? Well, as I said earlier, with route bricks, in order to support an external line rate R, we need each server to be able to process packets at rates between 2R and 3R. So given a server that is capable of this performance, this means that it can support external line rates between 8 and 12 gigabits per second. But given a worst-case traffic of minimum-sized packets, then we can support an external line rate between 2 and 3 gigabits per second. Okay, now this is a little bit disappointing, right? It's below the 10 gig ports that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk. So why did we not declare defeat at this point? Well, it's important to look at what limited our performance. In the case of most small-sized packets, I have already said it was the CPU. For realistic packet size mixes, we didn't hit any fundamental bottleneck inside the server at all. Our problem was that we were using a testing prototype which did not provide us with enough I/O lanes. So 25 gigs per second was the maximum amount of traffic that we could feed into our server. So we didn't hit any bottleneck at all. So what we did was look at the next generation Halem server, the same family of servers like the one we're using, but the next one coming up in less than a year. And that server will have four times the processing cores and multiple I/O lanes. And we do the back of the envelope. And here's the performance we expect. Okay, we expect the next generation Halem server to be able to route all the way to 70 gigabits per second. This means that we will be able to handle external line rates between 23 and 35 gigabits per second, and given a worst case workload of minimum size packets, between 8.5 and 12.7 gigabits per second. As a proof of concept, we implemented RouteFix. We built a prototype. We call it the RB4 because it consists of four commodity servers, each server handling one 10 gig port. We tried it, and it can handle 35. It can perform IPv4 routing at 35 gigs per second, given a realistic packet size mix, and 12 gigs per second, given a worst case minimum size packet workload. There's multiple issues that I did not have time to talk about. Reordering, first of all. We are using a load balanced interconnect, which means that we are introducing a certain amount of reordering. We did a lot of tricks to reduce that. We brought it down to 0.15%, and the details about that are in the paper. Latency is an important issue. We estimate the latency of each of our servers to about 24 microseconds, given that each packet crosses two or three servers with our in RouteFix, that we're estimating about 70 microseconds per packet. There's important issues that we did not cover with this work, yet maybe as important as performance, energy consumption, form factor, that is the amount of space that our solution takes. We did not consider that. And the programming model. So what model are we going to expose to the developer of router applications so that they can add their new exotic workload while having a predictable impact on performance? Let me conclude. I presented RouteFix. It's a high-end software router. It consists, it's a variable balanced cluster of commodity servers, a purely software solution. It's programmable using the Qlik programming framework. And in terms of performance, it can easily handle hundreds of 1 gig ports. We can also handle 10 gig ports, assuming realistic packet size mixes. And for worst case traffic, we expect to be able to handle 10 gig ports with upcoming servers. Thank you for your attention. And if you're interested in downloading and using our MIC device driver or want more information, you can check routeflex.org. Thank you. Because our bottleneck is the CPU, right? So depending on what kind of load balance you use, you're using more CPU cycles or less, so there's a trade-off to be struck there. If you care to do very fine-grained load balancing, you may need to be more careful, you may need to spend more cycles. So yes, it is an important thing to pay attention to.
So there are a couple of things you didn't talk about, you nicely pointed out at the end of the slide, but I would like to ask you for your opinion whether the trends on both power and power performance of these processors are in your favor to reach the next generation.
It's a very good point. So if we just took currently available servers and we build a router out of them, we would spend more energy than if we took the corresponding Cisco router, right? But there's also a lot of room for improvement. And there's a lot of pressure from the market to actually get commodity servers that spend low energy. So I do think that things will get better in that department. Now, that said, our point is not to say use these particular Intel servers. Our point is to say use general purpose CPUs. So if you want to build a really, you know, high-end router that's really low energy and very compact, let's say, then maybe the best thing to do would be to use general purpose processors, but with some, you know, specialized interconnect, for instance, that spends less energy. So yes, I do think that the trend is on our side, but on the other hand, I also think that depending on what you really want, for instance, your focus is energy, then it may make sense to look also at different solutions, not general purpose servers.
Okay. David Sherrod at Stanford. So, Katerina, I think you misrepresented the alternative. So let me take the devil's advocate here. The real options between general purpose processors you presented it and different model programmability in these hardware routers you referred to. So you have, as you know, you have ternary cams, you have DRAM-based filters, you have all sorts of stuff. And you say, I'll put the established stuff on the fast path, and then I'll have filters do a redirect off to general purpose processors. And I think people in the industry have looked at this and get slaughtered on the power cost to be trying to handle all this stuff. And I think you haven't given adequate play to this other model where you're basically just saying there is programmability, but it's just trapping some exceptional packets. So it seems to me that when you talk about intrusion detection and particularly, which is pretty CPU intensive, only given numbers for his IP routing and so forth, that's easy, right? That's everybody does that. What about intrusion detection? If you can just sample and detect intrusions, then you don't need this full programmability and you have a green router. So you haven't really given a comparison on
As I said at the beginning, there is a lot of ways to design a router that's programmable and fast. And I only took an extreme approach just to demonstrate what we can do. I'm not suggesting that, you know, an ISP will throw away all the hardware routers and replace them with something like this that is fully programmable. But you might want to do it for some routers. For instance, let's say that you want to do some form of new source record route, and you want to do that for all your packets, right? It might make sense, for instance, to upgrade the routers that are on the borders of your network. And if you have something like this, or if you have a programmable data path, that might make it easier to, you know, deploy a new protocol, but just on the borders of your network, that will make it very easy for you to, you know, implement new policies. I'm not saying that, you know, you should throw everything away and replace it with this thing, but there are some scenarios where you may want to do that.
I'm curious about this reordering phenomenon and how it would be affected by adding more layers to the router. It seems to me that any significant amount of reordering is going to cause TCP to have serious issues with flows that run through the routers. You said that in an example, you had reordering down to 0.15%. Is that assuming a single label, or would that be true for a router that had much larger numbers of nodes in some ways?
So, of course, the number depends on the workload you put, but we did this with a realistic packet size mix. So we took a real trace, and we tried to reduce the per-flow reordering within that trace. That's where this 0.15% comes from.
So if I was an adversary, what would be the most extreme kind of reordering that I could force?
I think you could force a lot of reordering if you were an adversary, but then you would end up causing your packets to be reordered, right? You're not going to affect the reordering that happens on other people's flows. That's the point.
I